Thanks everyone for coming out this early to talk about nukes. I'm Tom Zeller, Jr. I work for the New York Times. I cover energy and environment issues. And I'd like to just really quickly introduce our panel here. We have Paul Genoa, who is with the Nuclear Energy Institute. He has a couple decades of history working with them and within the nuclear industry on radiation protection issues, environmental issues. We have someone who probably needs no introduction to many of you, Roger Witherspoon, a veteran journalist, covering all kinds of things, including nuclear power, energy issues. And we have Richard Caperton here from the Center for American Progress. He's a policy director there, policy analyst there. He's testified before Congress on issues related to nuclear financing. And maybe you can help us dissect some of the loan guarantee issues as
sure.
well. I was going to go over a few orienting points that I scribbled down in the hotel room this morning. I'm sure there's a lot of expertise here that goes beyond my own, but just some statistics. The U.S. is the largest producer of nuclear power in the world. I believe 30% of nuclear electric generation is in the U.S. 30%.
20.
Is it 20? 20%, okay. We have 104 reactors here in the U.S., produced, according to the data I dug up, 799 billion kilowatt hours last year, about 20% of U.S. capacity, electric capacity. Is that correct, guys? You can correct me. But it has been more roughly a generation since that capacity was put in place. In the last couple of years, we started hearing about the nuclear renaissance, a lot of it driven by a number of factors. We had high fossil fuel prices. Oil and gas prices were quite high. We had a critical mass coming around, concern for carbon dioxide and climate impacts, and nuclear power seemed like a very perhaps a viable option in addressing that. We had federal loan guarantee programs directed at the industry to help spur it along, and so that all kind of seemed to augur a nuclear renaissance that admittedly still has not come. And now we're in kind of a different place where we're in a recession. We have natural gas prices that are quite low. I don't think anybody would argue with that. That's changing the economics of nuclear power. We have actually just very recently a major deal, despite the loan guarantees, the Constellation deal kind of going sour. So, and then on top of that, we still have problems with high-level nuclear waste that we haven't figured out quite how to deal with. We have, I think, lingering concerns among a lot of Americans over the safety and the regulation of nuclear power. And we have environmentalists who are divided on the merits of nuclear power and its relationship to solving a climate problem. So that seems to be, to me, the tableau that we're looking at right now. And I'll just kind of tuck into some questions to get us started. Maybe I'll direct the first one to you, Paul. You know, given that it's been 25-odd years, or at least a generation or so, 20, 30 years since this capacity that we have has been put in place, what's different now? How has the industry changed, matured, and is, you know, let's be simple, is nuclear power safe?
Well, certainly it's safe, but before I get into that, let me, one, thank you for hosting this. I want to thank SEJ for putting this panel on. We have been members of SEJ and have been participating for several years now. We think that its members, you, are key stakeholders in the issues that our industry cares about, energy, environment, and our economy. We think you're important arbiters of information that shape our future. So thank you.
Can everybody hear?
Thank you for having us here. How has our industry changed? While it is true no new plants have been ordered in a generation, 30 years, in fact, the last new plant, or the last plant completed was in 1996. There have been refurbishments along the way. We have added the equivalent in capacity. In the 1990s, our plants were running at 70% capacity on a fleet average. For the last decade, we've been operating above 90%, about 91% across the entire fleet. That's world-class performance. That means 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, these plants are operating. That increase between 70% and 90% is the equivalent of bringing 29 new large nuclear plants on site. So what we're doing, you folks all care about energy efficiency. Well, there's two sides of the coin. There's supply side and demand side. We're doing our part on the supply side. We're getting much more energy, 20% more energy, out of the assets that we already have, as I've mentioned. And how are we doing that? We're doing that by sharing experiences. We're doing that by improving the operation, the training of our operators, running the plants better. We're doing it because of new technology, the ability to use computer modeling, probabilistic risk assessment, new regulatory reforms that allow us to do preventative and predictive maintenance. So we don't wait for a part to break to replace it. We know when it's nearing its end of its life, and we do active management to replace it and keep those plants running. So that's the important thing. So the renaissance really started back in the 90s. The other thing we've been doing is making sure that we have a new regulatory process in place that makes it possible to develop these very large, very complex systems. Remember, a nuclear plant today is going to have a lifetime of at least 60 years. We're talking about several generations of jobs, jobs that can't be exported. Matter of fact, nuclear plants produce the most jobs per kilowatt hour produced. So our improved performance sets the stage for new plant development. The next thing we did during the late 90s was to expand the license of those plants to allow them to operate for an additional up to 20 years. Of course, the NRC can shut down a plant at any time for safety issue. So today, half of our fleet, 59 plants, have already received license extensions to operate for a full 60 years. And in fact, working with the Department of Energy and the Electric Power Research Institute, we're doing the research to find out what are the barriers that must be overcome to allow 60-year plants to go to 80 years. And we're evaluating that. We'll see whether that makes sense or not. But so we're adding asset value to the existing fleet, getting more energy out of the assets we've already put in place. Think of it like a really fine car. You can replace the tires. You can replace the brakes. If you really need to, you might be able to overhaul the engine. Think of it in that way. These plants, we're not just running them harder, but we're doing active maintenance. We're repairing them, replacing components, and so forth. That brings us to new plants. And the difference is today, new plants are being designed so they can be constructed in a modular way to provide larger output. Many of you have heard lately about small reactors, small modular reactors. So we're looking at additional low-carbon tools in the toolbox. These large reactors we have today will become complementary to these small reactors. Big reactors just aren't going to work everywhere. We were talking earlier about the rural co-ops and municipalities that really are too small to operate the large plants other than as a partnership. But with some of the small plants we're hoping to deploy around 2020, they're very interested in adding that to their portfolio, repowering some of the older coal plants, adding some generation, low-carbon generation. So I guess I'll stop there.
Define what you mean by large.
Large plants are the plants that are operating today. They're typically over 1,000 megawatts. They're sized to produce enough electricity for several million homes, large metropolitan areas, large population centers. For rural parts of the country, they're much too large. And so small reactors would complement them.
So, Roger, I want to get your reaction to some of what you heard there, and just a sense of you've watched the industry for
30 years,
a generation.
Yeah.
I'd almost ask you the same question. I mean, and to, if you have any reaction to what Paul was saying.
There are two. Good morning, everybody. We agree and disagree in some regards. A major change in nuclear power between now and, say, 30 years ago is that they were created during an era when you had publicly operated monopoly utilities. with guaranteed profits, oversight, etc. The capitalization was all taken care of during that period. In the last decade or so, you've had for-profit companies come in and take over. And as he said, their performance has improved. For-profit companies, which don't have the original capitalization to deal with, frankly, are much better at operating these plants than the utilities ever were. And part of the reason is that they will put up the money to keep the systems operating. In New York, where you have the Indian Point reactors on the Hudson River and five other reactors around the state, there were roughly 15, at any given time, 15,000 broken items at the nuclear power plant. If you walk through there, there were literally buckets on the floor catching steam dripping from pipes, condensate dripping from pipes, and there were aisles that were roped off because steam was leaking from pipes that were 2 and 3 inches thick. Their main feed water pump, which is about the size of a Mack truck, literally had two custom-made clamps on it because there were holes that had eroded through it, and they built these clamps that are, you know, big on each side just to keep it. And the first time I saw that, I went, "What's that?" And they said, "Oh, that's to keep the pressurized water in." I went, "Dang, you work here?" When Entergy bought it, and they actually took over September 10th, 2001, they did a walkthrough, looked at it, and said, "No, this is crap." And they spent $500 million replacing everything. And then they brought in the industry group, which has a INPO, what's the formal name of INPO?
Institute of Nuclear Power Operations.
One of the things they set up after Three Mile Island to do best practices and train staff. And they put the entire staff through training program, an in-house training program, to improve how they did what they did and make them more professional. And as a result of that capital investment and the investment in people, they went from about 70% operating performance, which means the amount of time that they're open, to over 95% fairly consistently. That plant was on the verge of shutdown, and it was always dangerous. It is far more safer in terms of how it operates and the risk of a catastrophic accident than it ever was under utility. And in that sense, the industry has really improved over the years in terms of how they operate. Now, the downside, and as journalists, what I look at is not the pie in the sky, but if you're going to inform the public, what else do you need to know? If you want to have a new generation, they cost a fortune. You need to ask how that happens. The industry is trying to get the public to pay for it. And that seems odd if you're saying this is so good and so safe. Why is it Moody's rates them as just above junk status and downgrades the rating of companies that want to build new nuclear power plants? A case in point is Exelon, which is the largest fleet operator. They're out of Chicago. Their rating is Baa2, which is two steps above junk status. They had a $900 million bond issue 3 weeks ago, which Moody's rated as A2. And I was curious about that, and I called up to, you know, why the rating? Well, that's because they were going to buy for $900 million the entire wind power development division of John Deere. And the rating agencies thought it was really smart that you were going to diversify into something safer, less costly, and more dependable. And so that bond issue had an A rating, while the rest of the company, for its nuclear operations, is just above junk. Since the public market, the free market, won't support it, they have turned to the government to guarantee it or basically pay for it. The collapse of the latest reactor project shows just how that works. The government said, no, put up 11%. Well, if you're going to shell out $9 or so billion, it seems reasonable that you should put up at least 10%. I mean, if I wanted to buy a house, I'd have to put up 20.
That's 11% on top of the 20% they have to put on. That's 33%.
You're not putting up 20%. They only wanted to put up 2, and that's why they got turned down.
No, that's incorrect.
Maybe this is a good opportunity to bring you into the conversation. Sure. and maybe talk to us a little bit about the federal loan guarantee program. Is it a good deal for taxpayers?
Okay. Yeah. If I could back up and talk about some observations on the nuclear industry for a few minutes too, I want to. The first, and I think the most important thing here, is that people know a lot more than we used to about coal-fired generation, and we know that living next door to a coal-fired power plant is much, much, much worse than living next door to a nuclear power plant. Coal-fired generation, which is traditionally our baseload generation, has a lot of problems, and I think people know a lot more about that than they did a generation ago, and that's led to a lot of renewed interest in nuclear power. The two things that and also I think that, you know, Paul's point is well taken, as is Roger's, that the nuclear industry has a pretty incredible safety record and should be commended for that. The two things that I would also note that have been touched on, the costs of nuclear power plants, cost projections continue to increase, and that's going to be a problem. And the other thing is this electricity deregulation and merchant generator issue is really, really difficult for nuclear power operators. You know, the bond ratings of merchant generators, it's not just because they're involved in nuclear power. It's because free market prices, wholesale market prices for electricity are very, very cheap right now. We have very low electricity demand. We have a lot of wind power coming on that has the effect of actually driving down wholesale market prices in a lot of markets. And it's really difficult for merchant generators, fossil fuel and nuclear generators, to compete in that market. You're seeing that with natural gas merchant generation as well as nuclear merchant generation. Just to touch on the loan guarantee program. So when the government issues a loan guarantee, they're not issuing a direct loan. That's a little bit different. They're saying they're not putting the cash out, but are saying, all right, borrower, you go to a bank, get the cash, and then if you can't repay it, we will repay it for you. So it's slightly different from a direct loan. The way the government scores this by law, according to the Federal Credit Reform Act of 1990, is that they have to put money in an account that covers the risk, the expected risk of default, minus the expected recoveries. So if the loan defaults and then you sell the assets, in this case a nuclear power plant, you're going to get some money back. So you're not just putting out $10 billion, you're only putting out $5 billion. There's a lot of complicated modeling here. OMB does a model. They use a model called the Credit Subsidy Calculator 2. Apparently the first one wasn't complicated enough. And so they use all this and generate a credit subsidy cost. That cost is the cost of a guarantee to the government. They do this for every single credit program, loan guarantees and direct loans. There are about $3 trillion of direct loans and loan guarantees outstanding in the federal government right now. About $2 trillion of that, just under that, is loan guarantees. This is in housing. It's in the rural utility service. It's in student loans. It's in healthcare. It's in infrastructure construction. It's all over the place. And this is generally a pretty well-run program. Now, the unique thing about the nuclear loan guarantee program is that for all other loan guarantees, Congress appropriates the cost of the credit subsidy cost. In the nuclear program, the borrower, in this case, Paul himself, pays the credit subsidy cost. And so when OMB and DOE calculate the credit subsidy cost, they charge it as a fee to the developer. They did it for Constellation's plant at Calvert Cliffs in Maryland and said that that fee would be 11.6% of the total size of the guarantee. That's unworkable for Constellation, and I'm very sympathetic to them not liking that fee. At the same time, the government has $3 trillion in loans and loan guarantees outstanding. They know how to calculate these, and I am pretty confident that that accurately reflects the risk of that plant. Now, you see some other plants. Southern is building a plant down in Georgia that we haven't seen public reports of what that credit subsidy fee was, but I suspect was much lower. That plant is not a merchant power plant. It's able to fold the cost for the nuclear plant into its rates, which will go up. It's not necessarily a great deal for the ratepayers. I think we could talk about that, but that does minimize the risk to the government. It's got some other things going on, too. It's got really good partners. It's got a municipal utility partner. It's got an electric cooperative partner. So the risk profile of that plant is generally lower. But so that's a little bit of background on the loan guarantee program and the Constellation plant. So.
What is the so this has been a great background. So what is the but let's get down to why do we need more nuclear?
Wait, can I add, can
yeah,
add, something,
you add something?
Yeah, you made the comment that it's safer living next to a nuclear power plant than a coal plant. I'm not quite sure why you say that. The jury's still out on those impacts because, as designed, commercial nuclear power plants release what's considered low levels of radiation into the environment, and how that builds up over time has not actually has not been measured.
But they actually are lower levels than emitted by a coal plant.
No, that's not true. That was one study that was done in 1976 when two-thirds of the plants didn't exist, and that was looking at mortality rates, and mortality rates take decades to show up. I mean, that was not a valid study. The government is, the NRC is now beginning a proper epidemiological study, but there wasn't one that existed before.
Can you guys speak up?
Sure.
Argue a little bit.
Sorry.
We can do that.
I'm quiet and shy.
So the book may still be out on living next door to a nuclear power plant. I think it's generally very safe. There is no doubt that living next door to a coal-fired power plant is very, very dangerous and very bad for you. Your kids will have asthma if you live next door to a nuclear power plant. You will die, a coal-fired power plant. You will die earlier if you live next door to a coal-fired power plant. There is no doubt about that. The National Academy of Sciences has done study after study after study on this. So I think that is what's really shaping the, I mean, we can argue about what it's like to live next door to a nuclear power plant, but there is no doubt about living next door to a coal plant.
I can assure you that I've worked at three nuclear power plants, and my family, my son was raised within the EPZ, emergency planning zone, of three different nuclear utilities, and I would certainly not bring my family into harm's way.
But you glow in the dark.
I was very comfortable. That's my personality. Very comfortable with that. Our safety record is really second to none. It is safer to work at a nuclear power plant than it is in a fast food chain, a real estate office, or a bank. And that is documented fact. So we can have conjecture and we can have proven fact. But let's go on to your question.
Well, I mean, going from there, I mean, what is the impetus? There are some, the downsides to an accident in a nuclear plant are fairly substantial. Are they not compared to?
Well, in a hypothetical sense, we have only had one significant accident in the United States. We did trash a reactor, a $1 billion asset, and we learned an awful lot from that. But study after study after study has demonstrated that although that was a terrible accident, there was no harm or injury to the workers or the public.
Well, there's a suit in federal district court in Chicago right now dealing with the release of contaminated water into the ground table, and all of the plants have leaked liquids containing tritium and a basket of other radionuclei.
Which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States has demonstrated and made clear to the public that they were not health risks.
No.
There's a lawsuit
no,
on everything
not.
Today.
No, they have not.
Yes, they have.
No, they have not. And that is...
We can agree on this.
Now that we've resolved...
Let's talk about nuclear waste.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. Setting that aside, we still have this lingering problem of what to do with the stuff after.
You asked the question of why is nuclear power? Why are people taking a fresh look at it? It's three things. It's the economy, it's the environment, and it's our energy needs. And if you want to have a prosperous economy, you have to have stable energy, electricity, and industrial process heat. Nuclear power, in combination with renewables and energy efficiency, are necessary. Study after study demonstrates to meet our environmental, economic, and energy security goals, we are going to need a broad portfolio of solutions renewables alone will not get the job done. You need low carbon baseload energy, and nuclear energy today, which produces over 70% of our emission-free energy, is really the only source out there. We hope there'll be other sources in the future, but that's what's bringing it out.
So why not? Did you want to respond to that, or
just it's emission free?
I mean, when we talk about the only source out there, I think it's important to put a cost qualifier on there. It's like there are always options out there, depending on what you're willing to pay for it, and at certain prices, different things exist. Nuclear power, I've heard anecdotally, in some cases, can be more expensive than wind power with storage connected to it. If that's the case, then that can be a baseload generator. I think that there's just a different – we just need to qualify that by talking about the cost of baseload generation. There are other options out there.
Yeah, the other item is when they say carbon-free, the Department of Energy considers it low carbon, not no carbon.
That life
and
cycle we do too.
I'm not even talking about life cycle. That to me is, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But when you deal with nuclear power, you have to consider the fuel cycle, because that's a step that your competing forms don't have. I mean, you take a lump of coal out of the ground, you can burn it. You take gas out of the ground, you take it out of the water, and you can burn it.
If you transport it.
They didn't transport it from that Deepwater well, Deepwater Horizon. They just burned. But if you take uranium out of the ground, it's got to be refined, it's got to be enriched, and that fuel cycle step is energy intensive. And the USEC plant in Paducah, is powered by two 30-year-old coal-fired plants provided by TVA. And those spew stuff that you would expect to find from a 30-year-old 1,500-megawatt coal-fired plant. In addition, when they banned CFCs 20 years ago because of its ozone-depleting characteristics, the one exception was in fuel enrichment, and they dumped 300,000 pounds of CFCs into the atmosphere every year at USEC in Paducah. And to put that into perspective, not all molecules are created equal, and a molecule of CFC, in terms of its radiative properties, is about 1,500 times worse than a molecule of CO2. And so it is not, for that reason, DOE does not classify it as carbon-free, even though if you look at just the power plant itself, you don't have emissions like you would if you were living next to a coal plant. But the Department of Energy feels that you have to include the fuel fabrication, the fuel cycle, as part of looking at nuclear energy. And for that reason, it's far better than coal, of course, but it comes closer to natural gas in terms of the emissions associated with it. But, I mean, it is relatively clean. It is low carbon, but it is not no carbon. In addition, you have to deal with the issue of once-through cooling, which two-thirds of the plants deal with. Have and the destruction that causes to the aquatic environment, which if you take a nuclear power plant like Indian Point, you're looking at roughly 2.5 billion gallons of water cycling through there in a heat exchanger every day. Now, for comparative purposes, the 9 million people in New York City and Westchester County use 1.4 billion. That plant cycles the equivalent of twice the Hudson River, 183 miles every year through its heat exchangers. It creates a thermal barrier that spans the river. It sucks in and kills about 1.5 billion fish a year. The thermal barrier kills another 500 million, according to New York State DEC, which did a study 1 year. As part of its water quality. Actually, big fish, as well as larvae and eggs,
That's fish.
And you can look at the study and find it. In fact, if you'd like to, the study is on my website. If you go to rogerwitherspoon.com, look at documents, and look at nuclear environmental impacts, you can read the DEC assessment.
Okay.
So, Paul, is there anything that it can be water intensive, it can be energy intensive. Is there anything that you disagree with categorically that Roger is saying here?
I would debate everything he said and put it into another perspective. But I think the audience wants to hear about waste issues and some other things.
Yeah, I think that we want to get to waste, and then we're going to kind of open it up for your questions. But, you know, that is the one kind of thing that we haven't touched on is, you know, whether or not you think it improves or is part of our quiver in dealing with climate change, for instance. We still have this lingering and pretty significant waste problem. I don't know, Richard, if you have thoughts on that. I mean,
sure. Not as a scientist, but as a policy person, I think the issue with waste is that until we decide what we're going to do with it, it's going to be really hard to build a new power plant. Especially in some states that have specific state laws against storing more waste on site. Obviously, those states, I think Minnesota, say, is in that case, they're not going to build new reactors. So that's going to hold back the renaissance in some ways.
They're also the largest water users in the state. And so if you are looking out west, where water is an issue, you would have to think twice about building a nuclear power plant.
Well, I worked at the Palo Verde project outside of Phoenix. I brought units 1, 2, and 3 online there as a corporate health physicist. By the way, my background is environmental health. I'm a trained environmentalist, graduated from Colorado State University, so I appreciate being here. That power plant at Palo Verde is the largest power plant in the United States. You know where it gets its cooling water? 100% of the cooling water comes from the city of Phoenix wastewater treatment, water that would otherwise be discharged. That water is cleaned up, shipped out to the plant, to the world's largest tertiary program, cleaned up, and after it's used, recycled 17 times, it is disposed, allowed to evaporate in holding basins. So you can engineer nuclear power to be very efficient in the use of water. I mentioned to you small modular reactors. Some of those designs, such as the Babcock and Wilcox M-Power design, is going to be designed to be dry cooled so that it doesn't need to be on a cooling basin. So if you are in an area where water is sensitive, you can deal with it. You also can use nuclear power to desalinate water, to clean up water that's not fit for humans, to make it suitable. Right now, over nearly 2 billion people on this planet don't have access to fresh drinking water. It impairs people's health routinely. Electrification is the biggest thing you can do around the globe to help improve the quality of life. Nuclear power offers one option, not the only option, to help achieve that. And so I can spend a lot of time talking about that.
Except the modular reactors right now is still just a theory. And in covering nuclear issues, it's important to deal with what exists and separate that from what may be coming down the road. As of Tuesday, there were no concrete plans for any modular reactors anywhere. The only thing the NRC has ever received is some white papers dealing with concepts. Now, whether those actually...
The NRC has been advised through what's called a regulatory information summary that there will be three, at least, reactor designs submitted for certification in 2012 and 2013.
Those are target dates, so they don't have anything now, and those things slip. But right now, they don't exist.
Okay, that's true. Okay.
So, that said, I'd like to open it up to questions. SEJ members have priority. I don't know who's who, so you raised your hand first. If you could identify yourself.
Jeff Neans from Fairfax Media in New Zealand, and some of the people here on the panel might be aware that we are one of a small number of legislative nuclear-free states on the planet, and it's something that defines our nation's identity, and as an aside, a centre-right political party legal was overhead to say that our nuclear-free policy would be quite gone by lunchtime if they were elected. They subsequently lost that election. Paul, my question is specifically for you. I wondered how easy you think it would be to sell new nuclear plants to American communities when, as my colleague at the back here has raised the issue of nuclear waste, and particularly given some of the points that Roger's made. We just don't want it in our backyard, and I wonder how you would sell a new nuclear facility to an American community, which obviously is aware that it has energy needs, but is also aware of the potentially long-term toxic effects of having one of these plants and the radioactive waste that comes with it?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And I'm sure you would acknowledge that New Zealand and Australia as well don't have nuclear power, largely because of its military applications.
Interestingly, though, Australia is where you're getting a lot of your uranium from, I gather.
No, it's one of the large providers in the world. So anyway, to get back to commercial nuclear power, in the United States, we are in pre-construction for four nuclear plants right now. Two are in Georgia, two are in South Carolina. We have 21 plants, applications under review by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There are communities across this country that are actually in competition to get the next nuclear power plant. You know why? Because you know when you're close to a nuclear power plant, the roads and schools are better. Nuclear power plants have a greater than 80% nationally approval rating, the communities that host them. There are communities with activists who don't like that technology. That's to be expected. But the vast majority of the people, excluding the people who work at the plant, support them because of the benefits they bring. So we don't have a single problem with siting plants for new plants, and we are going to move forward. The problems we have are what have been identified. We have an economy right now that is in the tank. We have lower electricity demand today than we did 2 years ago. And that isn't because we've implemented wonderful energy efficiency. It's because we're in a crippling economic recession. So we're going to push out new nuclear plant build for some time. And as was pointed out, we now have abundant sources of natural gas that were really not even, we weren't aware of them 5 years ago. Now, it remains to be seen whether that very low price we have today will continue long term. But we have to remember that as good as natural gas is, and it's a wonderful feedstock and fuel, it still has half the carbon of coal.
If I may add
real quick,
to that,
because we want to get some questions in, so go ahead.
Okay, the few nuclear the anti-nuclear activists in New York include the Attorney General's office and each of the four counties surrounding the Indian Point nuclear power plant. In Vermont, it's the state of Vermont and the state legislature which voted to reject its license application. they are major employers and revenue producers, and as a result, they have a lot of clout and a lot of influence. And for that reason, they are welcome in many of the basically rural areas where they are. They are major employers. They keep the property taxes down. They pay for roads and schools and keep your school taxes down. And so in those communities, you know, they tend to love them. Upstate New York, for example, where Nine Mile Point is on Lake Erie, they're asking for two or three new ones. Whereas downstate on the Hudson River, virtually every municipality and school system has passed resolutions asking for Indian Point to close. So it just depends on where you are.
So there's more acceptance in metropolitan areas, in rural areas than metropolitan areas?
Yeah, typically our nuclear power plants are not in large population centers. They're just outside. Indian Point is a notable exception. And in fact, as he points out, when you go to Surrey, Virginia, or North Anna, Virginia, it's very compelling when you talk to community leaders. When they say, we had a town that was shrinking, we had no economy. There was no reason for our children to stay here after school. But after the power plant was built, there were long-term quality jobs. The town grew around that. Remember, when you have a nuclear power plant, you have maybe 500-700 workers at each plant. And every one of those workers has a spouse and a family, typically well-trained people, typically paid about 30% above the national or the local average in wage. So it's a real boon to the economy. But
Joe, did you have something you wanted to add real quick?
Yeah, I'll just add quickly that the job creation is not unique to nuclear, obviously. Anybody that creates massive new electricity generation is going to create a lot of jobs. I know Paul has cited a study that it creates more jobs per megawatt hour. I'm aware of other studies that show different results than that. I'm also aware of his study. So I think the jury's still out on that. What the nuclear industry does a really, really good job of in communicating the jobs message is that most nuclear power plant jobs are union jobs, and that's, you know, the union members are really good at they're politically active and really good at stressing the value of those jobs. It would be great, a great lesson for the renewable industry would be to unionize more on the jobs that they have, and I think that would help get that message out more.
Wow, yes, go ahead.
Yes, John Addison, Clean Fleet Report. Glad you started on life cycle emissions. I want to get an expansion on that. Within the DOE, on transportation, Argonne has GREET models that are heavily used to look at the life cycle emissions of cars, of fuels. Yet on the energy side, everybody, you know, like Idaho talks about nuclear being emission-free. Why within the DOE such different approaches, and what is kind of the full story on life cycle emissions?
Well, you can have a different take.
I'd be happy to just weigh in, and I would just ask anyone who's interested in this question to look at Roger's site if you want, and look at the Nuclear Energy Institute, NEI.org. In there, under our carbon area, you'll hear what we have to say. You'll see if we spin it, that'd be fine. But we also list a variety of studies that all come to the conclusion that nuclear, in its life cycle, cradle to grave, has life cycle emissions similar to comparable to renewables. So,
so you look at the cement and building the plant.
You look at the mining at the front end, the enrichment, the fueling, the disposal at the end. And there are always dueling studies, so go look at several.
As I said, I do not look at life cycle. I think that's, you know, how many angels dance on the head of a pin, and you know how much shoe leather did I take to walk to that store. I mean, that to me is extraneous. It's a nice academic exercise, but I don't see where it's useful. In this field, it is useful in when you're dealing with bioenergy and how much water does it take to grow to grow the crops used in biofuel. But I'm not sure that it's useful here. What I do look at is the fuel cycle, because that is an extra step without which you don't have a functioning nuclear power plant. And that's what makes them different from your coal and gas plants.
The fuel cycle is included in the life cycle analysis.
That's true, but you know, the amount of concrete you use and pipes and all of that, all of them have an infrastructure. In looking at whether it's carbon-free or low-carbon, it's low carbon as opposed to no carbon because of the fuel cycle. It is a low carbon energy source, but it's not no carbon, and that's because of the fuel cycle.
Next in the back there.
Steve Johnson, independent producer. I still haven't heard the question about the waste. Where does the waste go? But also, how does it get there?
Yeah.
And for instance, you know, the four new plants you're talking about in South Carolina and Georgia, is the plan to get it to Yucca Mountain? What are they
going to
do?
So today, the law of the land is that that fuel will be taken by the Department of Energy to a national repository. Currently, the Yucca Mountain facility is in licensing with the NRC. The Department of Energy, at the direction of the Obama administration, has asked the NRC to withdraw that application. Currently, a judge has identified, or the NRC's judges have said that they don't have the authority to do that, that Congress directed the agencies to pursue this, and only Congress can change that. That will be in court for some time. We're suing DOE. Others are doing it as well. But that gets to the basic point. So what are the solutions to nuclear waste, and what's it all about? The first thing you have to understand is, what is nuclear waste? How many of you here know?
Spent
fuel rods? You're absolutely right. So it is ceramic pellets, ceramic like your coffee cup, inside of metal tubes. Within that, there is a few percent that are fission products, which where we've split the uranium atom. That is highly radioactive, lethal. If you're up close to it, needs to be managed very seriously. But think of a soft drink can about this size. that much spent fuel rod, if it was consolidated into that volume, would provide you electricity for your life. And that's how much waste there is when you're done. So it is a serious issue that needs to be managed, and we have been safely managing it for 50 years. All of the waste that has been created is currently stored where it was generated. If you were to combine it all together, it would cover a football field up to the goalposts. It is very small in volume because nuclear energy is a very dense energy source. Renewables are powerful and interesting. Chemical plants, anytime you burn biomass, coal, gas, any other kind of a fossil fuel, you're breaking a chemical bond. You get a lot of energy. Think about a gallon of gas will move a 2,000-pound car 30 miles. That's hugely energetic. That's just getting ripping the electrons in a molecule is where you're getting that energy. Nuclear energy is 2 million times that level of energy. So basically it takes 2 million times less fuel and produces 2 million times less waste on the back end.
I'm a little puzzled with your analogy about a bottle, since you're looking at 100,000 pounds of 12-foot rods.
I said volume. It is a heavy bottle, heavier than lead.
Roger,
we have 60,000 metric tons.
Which is a bit more than this?
In the country, after 50 years.
Go ahead. Let's just talk about the four new ones then.
Yes.
What is the plan? If Yucca Mountain, which is, how long has that fight been going on?
Since 1982. Okay. Not for Yucca Mountain, since 1987.
What's the plan for the four new ones? Is the idea that by that time, when they're done and they're online, that Yucca Mountain will be the option, or is it been agreed that they will stay on site until...
Well, they have no option but to stay on site until we have a repository or another plan. The administration has directed a Blue Ribbon Commission to evaluate America's nuclear future, including the fuel cycle.
Yucca Mountain would essentially be filled with what already exists. And so, with your new plants, you'd have to find another repository for them. And that hasn't been considered. And as journalists, you can get to tour Yucca Mountain,
not anymore.
And get a
Harry Reid cut the money for any tours to Yucca Mountain.
Actually, I went there 2 years ago on my honeymoon.
Yes, I did. Who else has it? Go ahead.
And there are problems in that it's a site that is likely to all sides, both the scientists who run it, who gave us the tour, and the state agree that at some point in time that will fill up with water. And the contention is whether having these canisters underwater will still be safe for ages or not. And the proponent's position is that they will, and the state's position is that you can't take the chance, particularly since the end of the San Andreas Fault is it runs through those mountains. Whether that works or not is still debatable, but that plant, but that site is not going to be able to hold and is not intended to hold whatever new generation comes from a new group of reactors. That is still up for grabs. They're more likely going to be on site, either in spent fuel pools or in time in dry cask storage. But there is no other repository. I mean, the reason we have Yucca Mountain is because none of the other states wanted it, and Nevada had no clout when Congress was deciding where to stick it. All right, and that's problematic for it getting a second site or anything else.
Okay, go ahead. You have a question.
Two quick questions.
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry. Gloria Gonzalez with Environmental Finance Magazine. Just wondering, you talked about some of the issues at Indian Point and Vermont Yankee. I'm wondering if you could comment on the future of those power plants going forward. And also, second broader question, what would be the impact of having a federal carbon price on new nuclear development in the U.S.?
That would turn the industry around. It wouldn't solve all the problems. Clearly, there are still some other issues. There's still cheap natural gas. There's still, in the short term, low electricity demand. But a carbon price really reshapes the electricity industry, and I think reshapes it to the benefit of the nuclear industry. John Rowe of Exelon has said that without a carbon price and with cheap natural gas, we're not going to see significant new, at least merchant, nuclear generators for the next 10 to 20 years. And I agree with that. The other thing that a carbon price does is it starts to address climate change. Nuclear power plants, I know there are certainly some exceptions to this, but in general, they use river water or some sort of cooling, open water cooling mechanism. There are limits on how hot that water can get. And when it's 100 degrees outside, you just can't use that much water to cool a nuclear power plant. It overheats it by law. So addressing climate change and cooling that water down would help the industry as well.
You asked about Vermont Yankee and Indian Point. You have two problems there. In New York, their license is being challenged by the state of New York, as well as several nonprofit environmental groups. But the big clout comes from the state, which the Attorney General's office has a full task force working on that. And that could go either way. It is not clear whether they will survive that or not. The issue from the state's perspective is even if they get a license renewal, they have to have a water quality permit in order to function. And that's being denied unless they go to closed cycle cooling and stop using the Hudson River as their cooling water source. Entergy does not want to spend the money for it. Now, Entergy's bond rating right now is Ba3, which is one step above junk, and they have $4 billion in debt in their nuclear division and don't really want to take on the additional cost. And it's debatable how much that'll be, but don't want to go to closed cycle cooling. It looks like they're going to be stuck with it because the state isn't picking on them. The state is done something very unique and unprecedented in the country, and that is New York and New Jersey are the only two states that have decided to enforce the Clean Water Act and force all power plants to go to once-through cooling. In New York, that means 40 different power plants, as well as four cement plants and a Domino's sugar plant to stop using the local rivers as a free source of cooling water. Indian Point, which kills about 2 billion fish a year, is not the worst when it comes to its destruction of the aquatic environment. The Northport plant, which is one of the few remaining oil and coal plants that produce electricity, since oil is basically not used for electricity in this country, it's only 1%. That plant, which is on the north shore of Long Island in Suffolk County, kills by itself about 9.5 billion fish a year. It's actually smaller than Indian Point, but because of its location at the mouth of Long Island Sound, it just vacuums in the fish coming in to spawn and kills them by the truckload. Indian Point is waging a public fight, calling it a fish versus jobs issue. Then it's not likely to win that because of the Clean Water Act. There have been several court cases, and while they are publicly maintaining that wedge wire screens are more effective than closed cycle cooling, the fact is that the state knows, even if the public doesn't, that they went to federal court and filed a brief in federal court in April 2006, which went to the Supreme Court in April 2009, saying that wedge wire screens are not suited for nuclear power plants because they're not designed for them. They're designed for lakes. They're not designed for high flow. They're not designed for large water intake, and they simply don't work on nuclear power plants. And so while their public relations campaign is wedge wire screens are great, the fact is they're not designed for that and can't work. In Vermont, your problem is that officials from Entergy lied under oath to the state legislature and testified that they did not have any underground pipes that carried radioactive liquids. And right after that testimony, there were leaks into the water table from these pipes that supposedly didn't exist. And as a result, the legislature voted not to renew their license. Now, whether that changes, I think there's a possibility of another vote next year, is up for grabs. But right now, sentiment seems to be against them. And remains to be seen what happens. But financially, they're kind of stressed.
Paul, do you want to respond to any of that real quick before we take another question?
I'll just say that the characterization that they lied under oath is inaccurate.
They said there were no pipes.
They said there were no underground buried pipes. The pipes were in a vault. That's different in our technology.
Okay. It's a vault underground?
Who has another question?
The important thing is that... go ahead.
Let's just move on.
Yeah. Tony Davis, a reporter with the Arizona Daily Star. Listening to this discussion, and I haven't really reported much on nuclear energy in a long time, I'm wondering, when is the next thing actually going to happen that might actually have a chance of driving this industry forward? I hear carbon price, that seems tied up hopelessly in Congress. I hear economy, we seem like we're going to be in the tank for years, and I hear nuclear waste. I would like to know when that Blue Ribbon Commission is going to get going, but if I was a reporter and we're going to, like, what's the next story to cover that it looks like something might happen? I'd be curious to get some
congressional elections.
Just all you have to do is look around the world today. There are over 61 plants under construction today. There are over 20 of them in China. There are plans to build many more, whether the U.S. goes forward or not.
Well, I'm talking about the U.S. because that's where I...
In the U.S., you should follow what's going on in Georgia and South Carolina. As far as the Blue Ribbon Commission, they were started about 6 months ago. They have to come out late next year. 18 months they were given to do their work. But they're going to come out with just recommendations. Then Congress and the administration will have to decide how to act on those recommendations. The nuclear waste issue, there was a waste confidence rule. It was just issued by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission a few weeks back. Where they made it very clear that they have confidence that the waste can be safely managed in dry storage for at least 60 years after a nuclear power plant closes, which will be 60 years in some cases in advance, and that they are confident that a repository will be available when needed for the material.
Both parties seem to favor increased nuclear development. The two states that he mentioned are, I think, the only two that allow for pass-through costs before the plant even exists. And you know, most states have rejected that approach. And so I don't know that it will catch on in other places because these are expensive undertakings, and they weigh heavily on your capital portfolio, and plants can't really undertake it unless there is some way of offsetting that. It remains to be seen whether they are financially viable as huge capital outlays. And as for the construction around the world, well, you know, I interviewed the Secretary of Commerce for Finland, and Finland has one of the new French design reactors, and his comment was the French were guilty of fraud. They sold us a plant that hadn't been fully designed. They don't know how to make the safety system work. It is now twice over budget and way over time. The French reactor, their new model, isn't completed and isn't effective. Now, what that does for sales of other ones, whether that people...
Well, the Finns have decided to go ahead with more, even
they,
with that situation.
Well, let's stick to the domestic question, which is what the original question was. It's like,
that does not help their sales here.
Richard, you wanted to...
You appropriately point out that there are a lot of barriers to this industry taking off. Paul talks about two or three reactors, maybe four, that have a really good chance of moving forward. There's an awful lot of hand-wringing among some and cheerleading among others for an industry that is going to bring on, I don't know, 4 or 5 new gigawatts of power by 2020. The wind industry last year brought on 10 new megawatts of power. That seems to be the story to me, is that there are alternatives out there. Nuclear power has a lot of benefits, and there are certainly some drawbacks to renewable power, but the renewable industry is taking off and working well.
And I would only share that if there was a level playing field, we would too. So the wind, as you point out, there are renewable portfolio standards that require renewables to be built. If it was a clean portfolio standard that would require it, you would see a different dynamic. the renewables also have loan guarantees where the subsidy fees are paid by you and not the industry. So again, I agree, and I think that the growth in wind is admirable and important and will continue. But I believe that nuclear is going to continue to be part of our future.
Richard, you seem to react to the level playing field.
I mean, the idea that, well, certainly RPSs are very valuable to the renewable industry. There is a reason that, and I understand the low carbon benefits of nuclear power and the other baseload generation benefits of nuclear power. Renewable energy has no fuel cost. It has that benefit to it. Renewable energy has no fuel waste. It has that benefit to it. Renewable energy lends itself to small-scale development, to local ownership. It has that benefit. It lends itself to rural development. It has that benefit. So I don't think we should just treat nuclear power as an immediate substitute for it, nor should we treat renewables as a direct substitute for nuclear power. And the fact that, you know, we can talk about level playing field, certainly the loan guarantees work differently for renewable power. Nuclear power has very comparable production tax credits, for new power.
Okay.
Very comparable, if not more advantageous, R&D spending from the government. So it's not like the nuclear industry is hurting for government support.
Go ahead, Brown.
Nate Poppenholm with the Times News Center, Twin Falls, Idaho. I'm a little curious. This is something I don't see discussed very often. Of course, and as it probably should be, a lot of the debate about the future of the nuclear industry is on the national level because that is where it is regulated. But with, if we're really going to see this increase in new plants and built in new places and spots that haven't hosted this before, I'm a little curious to hear your thoughts on dealing at the local level with the process before you move on to the licensing. What kind of challenges are there going to be there? And I ask it because we've had a company proposing to build a nuclear power plant in our area that has been hopping counties because the local county governments, just in the basic zoning process, don't know what to do with them. And so the process just stalls and freezes up, and partly it's due to some questionable behavior on behalf of both the company and its detractors, but it's also, you know, you sit through the meetings and you watch county commissioners just, what are we doing?
I would tell you, I mentioned earlier about a new licensing process. It was directed by Congress to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1992. They implemented the regulations in 96 and we're just now going to demonstrate those regulations. That's the time scale you deal with in the nuclear industry. But importantly, the design of that new licensing system includes sort of three steps. One is you need to get the reactor design certified in advance. You have public opportunity to get involved there. You also have the opportunity to get what we call an early site permit. Whether you get it or not, you have to do the environmental reviews. In that early site permit, you have this opportunity to engage the community up front with your intentions. We want to bring this technology to this community. Here are all of the ologies, seismology, geology, hydrology, that are going to be impacted. And there is a public process involved in that, which allows a lot of those issues to come forward. And then there's a combined construction and operating license that has to be applied for, and there are public interactions in that as well. All of that, by design, is done up front between a shovel goes in the ground, other than environmental monitoring.
But see, the thing is, they're not even quite to that point yet. They're still trying to get an industrial zoning change on the county level in a code that doesn't even account for nuclear power because the desert they never thought about.
If I may add something there, he's right about the public input, and the NRC is probably from my perspective anyway, the most open government agency in terms of media access and public access and documents and records, and everything that happens in a nuclear power plant is documented and you have access to it. If something goes wrong, there's an incident report, you can go right online and see it that day and see what really happened and what the ramifications are. The problem with new power plants is that while there is this public access and public hearings, generally you don't have the money to hire the expertise to really evaluate what you're looking at. Now, you know, in challenging the license renewal, for example, there were several environmental agencies, environmental organizations that challenged Indian Point's license. Almost none of them have got any standing because it's just a very intensive process. The state of New York, the Attorney General's office, put together a task force and then filed this 3,000-page challenge, hired its own mathematicians and health physicists and everything else. Well, the average town isn't going to do that. And so while you have a chance to have input, it's mostly listening. It's very difficult to actually wade through those documents and know what you're doing, and know what questions to ask. But it is an open process. If you ask questions, you will get answers. If you want to see the documents, they are there. You have local universities. You can take them to your local to Idaho State and ask the engineering school, "Will you tell me what I'm looking at?" Which, frankly, some of us journalists frequently do.
On the local government side, it's not directly applicable to nuclear, but I think would be. There's a fascinating article in the most current issue of the Electricity Journal, which I may be the only person in the world who reads it. But,
that's why you're so bright.
That's my Bible.
About the wind industry in Illinois and local government changes that have had to be made to accommodate that industry, including like road classification changes and the zoning issues that you're talking about. And I would encourage you to look that up.
There's one other example you might do, and while it's not nuclear, Jiminy Peak Ski Resort in western Massachusetts in the Berkshires decided they could cut their electricity costs if they put up a windmill. And so they petitioned the town and went through it, and everybody was skeptical, what will that do to the viewscape of the Berkshires? But they let them put up one to see what would happen. Well, A, it cut their electricity costs 70%, and all the farmers looked at it and finally said, why can't we have that? And so the surrounding, like, 10 towns got together, and all the city councils got together and said, all right, we want one. So now there are 10 windmills going up across that ridge in the Berkshires. And you could talk to them about, all right, what zoning changes were necessary to have that small wind farm go into the local grid. How do you connect it? What zoning things do you have to do? Because, I mean, that infrastructure you'll need for any power system.
Go ahead, Mindy.
Valerie Brown, freelance, back to the waste. As long as we don't reprocess, the existing waste can just sit where it is, kind of undifferentiated. As I understand it. And if we do reprocess, then the separation and there's a concentration of things like strontium and cesium into a package that's going to be really hot for a long time. And then there are these other long-lasting radionuclides like iodine-129 and things that also have to be captured and sequestered in separate media from the ones that you're going to put the really hot ones in, as I understand it. So
reprocessing is not like recycling and using it up. It's still there.
Yeah, yeah. I guess my real question is reprocessing not, I mean, what's the status of the idea of doing reprocessing in the United States? Is it going to come up again?
I'll share my perspective. You accurately point out some of the issues associated with recycling. So first of all, currently in this country, federal policy and the law of the land is we will not reprocess. That we will use a once-through cycle. We will take those ceramic pellets in their metal tubes, in their assemblies, and dispose of them intact in some kind of a disposal package, in some kind of a geologic repository. Right now we're looking at yucca. If it isn't yucca, it has to be something else. Under any conceivable scenario, there will always be long-lived radioactive waste that needs to be disposed of in a geologic repository. If, in fact, you were to pursue currently, as other countries, reprocessing, or what we would call recycling in the future, that is a more intensive, iterative process with advanced reactors to consume some of the bad actors, you have additional waste management flexibility. And we could spend a lot of time talking about what the advantages and disadvantages of that choice. All of that is being debated by this Blue Ribbon Commission. Recommendations will come out, and we'll see where we go from there. But in all cases, some disposal is necessary. There are no magic solutions.
Yeah, I think that the nuclear industry has done a really good job of allaying fears of proliferation risk. And if we reopen this reprocessing debate, I think that we start talking about proliferation risk again and security risk. And I think that's going to stop that conversation pretty quickly.
So the federal government isn't going
to... I see that being a long way away.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Go ahead.
I'm sorry I'm late, but maybe you've already covered this. In his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, James Hansen, he's very pro-nuclear. He devotes a whole chapter to it. He says that the renewable sources aren't just going to develop fast enough or come along fast enough to save us, because we're running out of time so rapidly. And I just wondered what your reaction might be to that.
I think, as was pointed out earlier, we have 440 nuclear plants around the world right now. None of them were built for climate change. They're built for energy security, emission quality of other issues, energy security. But today, I think the climate issue has further sort of driven a wedge between mainstream environmentalists who are looking for solutions to our environmental problems and anti-nuclear activists who have been stopping our development all along. And you're seeing a growing recognition, whether it's Hugh Montefiore, whether it's Jim Hansen, whether it's James Lovelock, the father of the Gaia Theory, whether it's Patrick Moore, co-founder of Greenpeace, whether it's Stuart Brandt, the editor of the Whole Earth Catalog that you all may have read as a youth. All of these folks who are big thinkers are looking at nuclear and seeing a role for it in our future.
Yeah, well, you're looking at folks who don't specialize in nuclear power. That's like going to Ducks Unlimited to ask them about tigers. James Hansen. When you read James Hansen's book, James Hansen said he read a book about nuclear power, and he quotes from that book. When I asked him, well, what research have you done, since that's not climate change, that's not climate science, that's not your field, he said, none. I read a book about it. So I dismiss him as not knowing what he's talking about. He likes the idea, but it's not his area of expertise.
Well, I don't think... Sorry.
Go ahead. Well, I mean, that's a question that I have. I cover a lot of climate change issues. I mean, how important is nuclear power in addressing this?
It is important.
Yeah, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in their fourth assessment report identified nuclear as a key mitigation technology.
It is a low-carbon technology, okay. And if you're strictly looking at its impact on the climate and environment, nuclear power has a major place, but you know, I don't look at Hansen as my guru for that, or Whole Earth Catalog. Okay, I go to a retailer. I mean, why is that any better than going to Walmart to ask for?
Yeah, I think there's. It's not unanimous that nuclear power is a solution. Certainly, Al Gore is one of the leading voices on climate change, and he is very skeptical of nuclear power. He comes from working with the Oak Ridge National Laboratory and TVA, and I think has significant nuclear experience and is skeptical of it. We also have, contrary to public opinion of government spending, we have a finite amount of money that we can spend on solving climate change. And we need to spend it in the most cost-effective way. The costs of wind power, the cost of storage, the cost of solar, the cost of geothermal all consistently and constantly come down and have been for a long time. Now, I recognize that they're not perfect substitutes by any means for nuclear power, but the cost of nuclear power continue to increase. And I think that we can't just talk about low carbon, there needs to be low carbon and a cost associated with it. Talking about just one side of that doesn't make sense and seems fairly arbitrary to me. When we tie in the cost side, then I think a lot more people become more skeptical of nuclear power. I think that after Southern builds their plant in Georgia, after potentially a new plant in South Carolina come online, if those plants manage to, and I'm doubtful of it, but if they manage to come online below budget and in a really cost-effective way, then I think that's really going to turn momentum for the nuclear industry. Until then, I think it makes a lot of sense to keep investing in renewable energy and keep investing in nuclear power too, but I think we need to be very, very careful about putting all our eggs in one basket.
I agree 100%.
Okay. We are officially out of time. Unfortunately, I've been encouraged to be strict about that, getting out of the room so they can set it up. But I think that everybody would be kind of happy to answer questions as we get out. And
we have a half an hour break. Some of us that want to ask some additional questions, hang out with you.
I think that's fine. Yeah, sure. So thanks. I'll say thanks officially, and then I think we'll all kind of,
thank
whoever
you,
wants
Todd.
To huddle,
thank you.
Feel free.
Yeah. Thank you all.
Thank you.